Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, diplomatic correspondent and senior contributing editor for the Jerusalem Post, back from hiatus. It's just me this week. Yaakov will be returning soon. And we have a special episode marking this time in the Jewish calendar. We're now in the time that's known as the 9 days. They're the days leading up to Tisha B'Av, the second most important fast day on the Jewish calendar. And these are sort of considered a solemn, sad time on the Jewish calendar because Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av, marks the day on which both temples in Jerusalem were destroyed, as well as a number of other tragic events in Jewish history. And so we're going to have a bit of a special episode in honor of this time of the year. We're going to have Ophir Dayan, the head of students for the Temple Mount, to speak about what is the current situation on the Temple Mount for Jews who want to visit. She herself was recently banned, so we'll be hearing more about that. And then, you know, according to Jewish tradition, one of the reasons that the temple was destroyed was a lack of unity between the Jewish people. You know, really strong divisions that led to our downfall. And so I wanted to bring in someone who is doing work to unite people. And I have as a guest Joseph Gittler, the founder and chairman of Leket Israel, Israel's biggest food rescue organization. And I think that he has brought people together from all walks of life in Israel to really help out the weakest members of our society. And so he will be here to tell us more about what his organization does. But we are going to start with our usual news talk. I'm going to have on Tova Lazaroff, settlements reporter for the Jerusalem Post, to talk with me about some of the latest diplomatic news, including the recent demolition of a terrorist's home, a Palestinian terrorist's home, which the U.S. strongly opposed, and the Israeli government, led by Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, decided to go through with anyway. And we will discuss why that happened and what the implications are for the U.S.-Israel relationship going forward. And we're also going to talk about a flurry of meetings and phone calls between Israelis and Jordanian officials, including Bennett with King Abdullah of Jordan, and also a phone call between new President Isaac Herzog and King Abdullah. So let's get started. I'm here with Tova Lazaroff, deputy managing editor and settlements reporter for the Jerusalem Post, and often my partner in reporting on diplomatic news, to talk about some of the interesting things that have happened in the last week. I think we should start with Jordan. Jordan has been all over the news for about a week now.
Yeah, Jordan would be great. I mean, Jordan's one of like the most fascinating, it's just one of the most fascinating stories because it really was one of, as you know, I mean, it was one of Netanyahu's real failure points. That relations got to such a low point with Jordan. And even when Netanyahu was still in office, if you spoke to people, what they said was water. Water was definitely the way to rebuild a relationship with Jordan because Jordan suffers so much from the absence of water. It's taken in so many refugees. And instead of doing that, Netanyahu really delayed even providing them with a very small request. They had requested under Netanyahu like this 3 million cubic meters, and he delayed it and delayed it. Then finally he did it. And now, you know, within a month, Bennett has made this massive gesture to Jordan.
So we should just tell our listeners who might not know that last week, Foreign Minister Yair Lapid met with his Jordanian counterpart. And a few days before that, Bennett met with King Abdullah of Jordan, and Israel agreed to send double the amount of water that it usually sends to Jordan. They're selling it. They have not set the price. My understanding from talking to people in the Prime Minister's office is that it's not as steep a discount as what they're required to send from the peace agreement, but still at a discount.
And also, we've never, I mean, short of the peace agreement, we've never sold them water at that low a price. So even if we did it at not that, if we didn't do that same discount, you know, it would still be a massive gesture, and even more if we actually did it at that discount. I mean, that would be amazing. So I just think it's an amazing coup. I mean, you know, you can weigh in here, but I just think it's an amazing coup on Bennett's part that he did it so quickly, so fast. And, you know, it's obvious kind of why Netanyahu then attacked him.
Yeah, well, and the other part of the agreement was that the Jordanians can export more goods to the Palestinians because Israel controls the border between Jordan and Israel, which is on the West Bank. And so that's important to Jordan as well. Because they have such close ties with the Palestinians, most Jordanians identify as Palestinians, and their economy is not doing great, so that's really helpful to them. But yeah, but going back to the broader implications, I think, you know, there's been a long history of Netanyahu having not so great relations with Jordan, even going back to his first term in office when there was the attempt to assassinate Khaled Mashal in Jordan, and then King Abdullah's father, King Hussein, you know, just basically told Netanyahu, you have to send the antidote to Jordan. So that's like, you know, really ancient history. But more recently, right, things heated up over the Temple Mount. You know, one of the more, I guess, maybe it was 5 years ago already, that Israel put metal detectors up on the Temple Mount after there was a shooting on the Temple Mount and eventually took them down amid Jordanian pressure. You could tell us about the whole thing with Naraim and Safar.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, we, you know, Jordan leased to us land, farming land at Moshav Tzofar, and also it allowed us to access land that Jews own, but which was now technically part of Jordan. The 1994 peace deal really got hung up in some cases on some very small details, and these were two of the details, that this Jewish-owned land was behind, you know, was going to be part of Jordan, and that Tzofar would also be part of Jordan. The way they got around it is they said, well, it, you know, Israel will be allowed to make use of it, and then there'll be a moment where Jordan can decide whether to extend that lease or not. And particularly the land at Naharaim, which was known as the Island of Peace, it became really symbolic of the cooperation between the two countries, how two enemies could come together and make peace and come to some kind, this kind of an agreement. And then because relations had gone so cold, and also, you know, and part of that also what, you know, instability in Jordan itself, that Jordan felt it couldn't afford to make a gesture to Israel, and it had no reason to. That was the other thing. And so, you know, then it didn't extend either of those agreements. And as a result, you know, we can't access, you know, our land in Naharaim, and we had to give up the land that they had been farming for many years and in Moshav Tzofar. And that is only, you know, it's only just a small piece of the many, many things that went wrong in that relationship. I mean, the other thing that's really important is Jordan is our longest border. And so relations with that country, the stability of that country is critical to the security of Israel. We talk a lot about how important the Jordan Valley is, but, you know, that presumes also a stable Jordan, right? I mean, that entire area, both the Jordan Valley and the country of Jordan, that's what separates us ultimately from Iraq and Iran. And so stability, you know, in Jordan, that's our first border of defense. So you don't want to play around with that.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. Well, you know what? Let's talk about one more incident before we talk about the argument between Netanyahu and Bennett. But the one more incident that happened recently that I think is important in this whole saga is that King Abdullah's son, Prince, do you remember the name? I don't remember his name. He has a son. Who's the crown prince, who's the heir to the throne in Jordan, and his name has escaped me. He wanted to visit the Temple Mount recently, and Israel and Jordan sort of didn't agree on the security arrangements. And so when he arrived at the border crossing, he had sort of more armed guards than Israel had agreed to let in, and he wasn't allowed into the country. And that the day after Netanyahu was supposed to fly to Abu Dhabi to visit the UAE for the first time after the Abraham Accords had been signed. And he was going to fly, or the Emiratis had sent a plane that was supposed to fly via Jordan. And basically the Jordanians blocked the flight. So it was this little tit for tat that happened earlier this year. So now, and I also would say, like, I think we're discussing a lot of things that Netanyahu did that were bad for the relationship, but we can't discount the role that King Abdullah himself played. I think that the Jordanians have been like with this case with his son wanting to visit the Temple Mount, they've been petty about a lot of things. They have amped up their rhetoric against Israel. They've made no effort to turn this peace into a peace between peoples and not just a piece of paper that's signed between two governments. Unlike his father, who I think, you know, who is known for having made more serious efforts. And so, you know, again, I think Netanyahu did make mistakes, but I think that there were mistakes on both sides. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think for sure. Look, for sure, there were mistakes on both sides. It takes two to tango, but it, you know, it also takes two to fall apart. I think we just never, you know, Jordan could easily have also agreed as a gesture to Israel. Maybe they could have used, you know, Tzofar and Naharaim as an instance to try and turn a new leaf with Israel and extended it, maybe even, you know, in exchange for this or that. But I think with Jordan, we just never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. In other words, we fell down on our end and we didn't give them any reason to up their ante. And that's, you know, before we even talk about the Temple Mount, which they feel, you know, such a strong connection to. And it's even written into our, you know, into the peace deal that they have a special custodial relationship with Israel. And, you know, we just have never taken that as seriously as we should. I just feel there are just so many.
Do you think that? Because I feel like the walk really controls what goes on in the Temple Mount beyond like police work.
Well, no, I think, you know, there was that whole story about how as part of the Trump, you know, as part of the back and forth underneath the whole Trump deal, you know, there was this possibility that maybe we were also going to give Saudi Arabia, you know, a foothold in Jerusalem, maybe even right on the Temple Mount in exchange for normalized ties. The fact that somehow that story circulated and that, you know, it was kind of known that we didn't consider, you know, that initial deal and that initial agreement so sacred. I think again, many things that both sides could have done, but since we're talking in Israel and we're evaluating the Israelis, I just feel of all the places, you know, you can't, I mean, Netanyahu, you have to give him credit for the UAE deal, you know, for the relationship with the Gulf states. I mean, that was just such a massive achievement. And, you know, you don't want to knock it. But if you're looking for the places where he really fell down, I mean, Jordan was just such a large acknowledged one. And, you know, that Bennett moved in so quickly to particularly, you know, try and make repairs with that one very specific relation there. I think it's significant. I think it's also significant in terms of ties with this new administration. It's significant in terms of the Palestinians. I just think it was a bright move. I just think it was a bright move all around.
Yeah. And so in the Knesset this week, Netanyahu attacked Bennett and claimed that selling more water to Jordan empowers Iran. Now, I tried to sort of figure out where this idea was coming from. I talked to a lot of experts and none of them thought it had any credence. And that the only articles I saw, which by the way includes an article published in the Jerusalem Post, but were by sort of Jordanian opposition exile figures who dislike the king. But an assessment that I saw that I thought was smart was that actually, well, I should back up. So Netanyahu says that Jordan is empowering Iran, helping Jordan is empowering Iran because Jordan, Egypt, and Iraq are working on an oil pipeline together. And Iran effectively controls Iraq. But an analysis that I saw that I thought made more sense is that Iraq actually exports gas and electricity to Iraq, and that this pipeline would make Iraq less dependent on Iran. So it actually would do the opposite of empowering Iran. So I thought that was interesting. And Bennett also sort of got up on the Knesset stage and was just like, what are you talking?
Yeah, I'm with Bennett. And I also think, you know, in the battle, as I said, in the battle with Iran, Jordan is our, you know, our best, it's our best defense. So the notion, you know,
on land.
Exactly. And so this idea, as somehow we're now trying to paint King Abdullah, you know, who among Arab leaders is a moderate, you know, it's, as aligned with some of the more radicalized forces in the Middle East. I don't even know. It's creative. It's a creative spin. Yes, I'm with you. I don't buy it. I think he needed to save something. And, you know, when you get bested so quickly, so easily by, you know, one of your arch political nemesises, so you're going to come back swinging.
Yeah. We have a couple minutes left. Let's move to a different topic that you had covered a few days ago, which was the demolition of a terrorist home.
Oh, yeah.
And the U.S. response to it. Want to sum up the story for our listeners?
Oh, yeah, sure. So, you know, Israel has a deterrence policy in place about demolishing the homes of people who are believed to have, you know, been responsible for the death of Israelis. So, you know, if you were a terrorist and you've killed, if you're a Palestinian terrorist and you've killed somebody in a terror attack, then you have to know that Israel is going to go and demolish your home. And the hope is that knowing that your actions could have such a huge impact on your family would deter it. Now, you know, it loves.
So whose home was demolished last week?
Right. So I just wanted to say, you know, you might also want to mention the whole issue of the terror payments, which were incentive. But in this case, what was very unusual about this case is that the Palestinian terrorist who was responsible for killing Yehuda Gueto, age 19, at the Tapuach Junction, basically in a drive-by shooting in the beginning of May. So his name is Munsir Shalabi, and he held American citizenship, mm-hmm. as does his wife, as do his children. Now, he and his wife are estranged, and he doesn't live in the house, and the wife lives there with, I believe, three of her seven children. But any which way, it was enough of a connection for this policy to be in effect. And there is a lot of tension anyway right now between Israel and the United States and really the international community, because Israel has a pretty stiff policy of demolishing homes illegally built by Palestinians. And while that sounds simple, you know, well, you built it illegally, so then it gets taken down. But because it's so hard for Palestinians to get permits to build, it becomes very complicated very fast. And so Israel has a policy of demolishing illegally built homes. There's already a lot of tension between Israel and the international community and the United States, particularly, you know, the Biden administration, which sees housing as a human rights issue and takes this issue very seriously. Then you add in the second issue, which is, you know, Israel's argument that home demolitions are a deterrence. And then you add in that this guy has American citizenship. And so the Americans, you know, had conversations with Israel at a very high level, you know, with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, you know, speaking personally to the Israelis. And then Israel went and, you know, they took down the home anyway. So it was really.
And what was the American reaction?
Oh, the American reaction was very quick. I mean, it's funny, people have made an issue. Well, they didn't use the word condemn. And it's true, they didn't use the word condemn when they said very publicly how displeased they were. But I don't think you need it, because the language was so particular, where they spoke about how they had personally asked the United States. And they don't often speak about behind-the-scenes conversations. And they spoke about how they were going to make this a priority. And then they said that they were going to pursue it. In other words, they weren't even going to let it go. So right. I find the response very unusual and very sharp, particularly you're only a month in and this is your honeymoon period. So, you know, and if you just go back to the Knesset for a second yesterday, you know, and one of the things that Netanyahu has really been attacking Bennett on is the fact that, oh, yeah, this guy... He can't stand up to the Americans. Only I can stand up to the Americans. Well, you know, if you want to know if Bennett can stand up to the Americans when he feels there's a principled point, then most certainly, you know, he did that here.
So do you think that this is going to have a big impact moving forward?
I think for the moment, it's like a fissure. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like you see the crack in the wall or you see the leak and you go, huh, I don't know if I have to fix it right this minute, but it's there. And if you don't repair it, it's only going to get bigger, right? It right now there is a honeymoon period, and, you know, Bennett made this gesture to Jordan, which the United States very much wanted him to make. I mean, in the fact that they so quickly, you know, sort of attacked his decision to take down the home, they also very, very quickly, you know, thanked him for Jordan. And, you know, both Bennett and King Abdullah are heading to Washington this summer. This is all part of the pregame, right, to those visits. And some of what we do here now is going to fashion the outcome of those visits. So I don't think it's like such a huge thing right this minute, but it's a reminder that Biden, you know, the Biden administration takes human rights very, very seriously. It takes Palestinian human rights very seriously. It sees homes as a human rights issue. And if we don't change, if Israel doesn't change some of its policies, it's going to go head to head. And that tension's going to rise. You know, every in diplomacy, you have to choose your battles. Right? Where are you going to stand and where are you going to fall? So, you know, on the list of battles that we have to have with the United States, I think, you know, the question comes, do we have to have this one?
Right. Well, Bennett sees it as a matter of national security, although I know in actual Israeli security circles, it's not such a done deal. It's a debate that people have.
Well, it's more than just a debate. I mean, what we've done, we have a long history of doing this. But if, you know, as you know, I mean, Ariel Sharon, when he was prime minister, he discontinued this practice. Mm-hmm. And there was an entire theory at the time that, in fact, it wasn't a deterrence, the opposite, that it inspired terror, that the idea that, you know, that doing an action that impacted a circle of innocent people then inspired people who might otherwise have thought to act or turn to terror. It inspires them, you know, to pick up terrorism. So it's certainly an active debate.
Yeah.
And even within the policy history of the country, it's an active debate. Ariel Sharon not exactly, you know, being seen as a weak prime minister on military issues. He's, you know, he's seen as one of the pillars of Israeli security.
Certainly. Yeah. All right. Well, I think this is a story that we're going to have to keep following. So thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you. This was so much fun. Super appreciated it.
We'll have you back again soon. I'm here with Ophir Dayan, an activist with Biadenu, one of the major organizations advocating for Jewish rights on the Temple Mount. I'm here to talk about the latest from the Temple Mount. So could you give our listeners a little bit of background if they're Jewish? And they're interested in visiting what is Judaism's holiest site. What do they have to go through to do that?
It's really important to mention that even before they come to the Temple Mount, there is a barrier. There is a barrier of understanding that the Temple Mount is Judaism's holiest site. I grew up in a secular education system for 12 years. I never heard the words Temple Mount. Until I was 20-something, I thought Judaism's holiest site is the Western Wall. Which is only holy because it was one of the supporting walls, allegedly, of the temple, which is not even true. But putting it aside, I think that coming to the realization that you need to visit Temple Mount is already a big step taken by many Jews, because I do feel that the education system is not talking enough about it. But say that they did come to the realization that they want to visit the site, they would counter a lot of other barriers. For example, there are many gates to the Temple Mount, to the old city of Jerusalem, as you all know, but only one of them is accessible to Jews. What was once called the Mogrebi Gate, now we changed its name to the Hallel Gate in memory of Hallel Ariel, who was murdered in Kiryat Arba and frequently ascended to the Temple Mount. So this is the only gate through which non-Muslims can ascend to the Temple Mount. And I say non-Muslims because it's not only Jews, but also Christians and other tourists who are visiting the Temple Mount can only ascend through the Hallel Gate. And in only very limited times during the day, during summertime, they can only visit from Sunday to Thursday, 7 a.m. to 11 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. to 2:30 p.m., very limited hours. And as you can probably understand, hours that are not very convenient for those of us who are working or studying. So even if you manage to come there during the day, obviously Saturday and Friday, it's closed to Jews, and any time that is not 7 to 11 or 1:30 to 2:30 is also closed.
I visited the Temple Mount, it's probably like 5 years ago now, and at the time, there were these groups, mostly of women, who were sort of harassing Jewish visitors to the Mount and screaming at them, basically screaming at them, Allahu Akbar, most of the time. And shortly after I visited and I experienced that, I understand the police got rid of those groups. So what is it like now?
So those groups of women are banned from the Temple Mount. That does not mean that Jewish worshippers are not harassed in the site. There are women who are still screaming at you, but not as organized group as in the past. The Waqf is still controlling, the Jordanian Waqf is still controlling the site. So when a Jewish group would ascend to the Temple Mount, which is super important, Jews who... for lack of a better way to say it, look like Jews, they cannot ascend on their own. They have to be escorted by police and ascend with a group of other Jews that they would not necessarily know, but they just gather Jews together and ascend together with police escorts. So when they would ascend, they would encounter a lot of Waqf officials. So your first, the first person you see on the Temple Mount is a Waqf official inspecting how you dress. The Jewish modesty rules are not enough for them. So even if you're, for example, shoulders are covered, they would want sometimes your elbows to be covered as well. And when you walk into Temple Mount, which is for those of your listeners who have not been, it's huge, not like it's depicted in the news. You would encounter a lot of Waqf officials who are escorting the Jewish group, inspecting if, God forbid, someone moves his lips or shakes as something that looks or might look like a prayer. And if they see someone doing one of those things, they would tell the Israeli police officers who would come and arrest or detain the person who was allegedly praying or singing or moving.
So I heard that you were recently banned from visiting the Temple Mount. You want to tell us what happened?
Yes. So, you know, I frequently ascend the Temple Mount. I go there very often. I know their briefing that they give you by heart, and the briefing is very specific. They say that you cannot engage in any religious activities, and you cannot pick anything from the ground. I know it sounds really weird, but you can't take leaves or sand or anything with you, and you can't perform any religious ritual. A few months, I actually do it for many years. I don't know why all of a sudden it became an issue. I would sing Hatikvah, the Israeli national anthem, to myself while I was there, because I think it's very symbolic. One of the lines is being free people in our homeland, Zion, in Jerusalem. And we're not free on the Temple Mount in Zion. So I started singing it to myself. I'm not a religious individual. For me, this is my prayer. You know, what's holy to me is not necessarily divinity. What is holy to me is Jewish peoplehood. So Hatikvah, for me, it's a very important aspect. I started singing it. I did it for many times and nobody said anything. One time that I did it, a police officer came and told me, you know, stop doing that. And I said, stop doing what? And he said, you know, and walked away. The second time, he told me that everything I'm doing on the Temple Mount is recorded. I know what I did. He knows what I did. And I was like, okay. And again, I think it's illegal to ban religious practice, but even if you do, Hatikvah is not a religious practice. It's a completely secular. And then the third time I did it, that they know of, they waited for me outside the gate when I left the compound, and they told me that I'm banned from ever ascending again until I meet with the head of the Holy Sites unit in the Israeli police, so he can tell me how wrong it is what I did.
Have you met with him? Because this was just last week, right?
Right, that was last week. And by the way, I think it's really important to mention at no point when I asked, they told me that what I did wrong was seeing Hatikva. I had to insist and tell them, tell me what I did wrong. I'm not going to go to that meeting until I know what you're charging me with. And they really, you know, tried to be vague about it. After, you know, like 20, 30 minutes that I'm talking to this police officer, he said that what I did wrong is seeing a tikva. I am not going to hide that I did that. I did that. And even in their strict and ridiculous and illegal regulations, singing a tikva is allowed. It's not a religious practice, and I'm going to insist that. I tried meeting with the head of the Holy Places Department. I did not get answered. I tried calling many times. They never answered the phone. But I got forwarded a document that was crafted by the legal advisor, the legal counsel for the Jerusalem district in the Israeli police. And there mm-hmm. he said that it's illegal for the police to ban people from ascending until they talk to this commander. And if they want to condition ascendance on being briefed, that one of the commanders on the ground has to brief me. They can't tell me to come to their offices in order to right. brief me. So tomorrow, tomorrow morning, I'm going to arrive at Hallel Gate and demand to ascend or be briefed on the spot. We'll see what happens.
So I want to just sort of broaden this from just your story in the couple of minutes we have, that the activists working on the Temple Mount issue, I think their issue here is that yes, there is a mosque on the Temple Mount and Muslims pray there every day, but that it's also holy for Jews and also Israel is a country with, you know, free speech and freedom of worship and that Jews should also have rights there. But if we play devil's advocate a little bit, right, the argument is often that Jews coming up there and praying or singing Hatikva is seen as a provocation by the Muslim worshippers, by Jordan, which administers the site, and that's the reason why they put all these limitations. So sort of how do you respond to that? Because it has been the sort of nexus of a lot of violence over the decades.
Right. So first of all, let me say that if someone views a prayer as a provocation, they are the problem, not the prayer. I mean, it's completely unreasonable to see a prayer as a provocation. The way that I don't view their prayers as a provocation, I view them flying Hamas flags on the Temple Mount as a provocation, but not their prayer. The second thing I want to say is that I recently ascended to the Temple Mount with a very famous Israeli TV personality who is doing a documentary about issues in Israeli society, one of them being the Temple Mount. And she met with a lot of people before coming to the Temple Mount. And when we ascended, you know, the one thing, religious, secular, women, men, young, old, the one thing we all told her, is a quote saying, my house would be a house of worship for all peoples.
And it's a quote from prayers, from Jewish prayers.
That's the way we all view it. For me, you know, I don't really use that quote because I'm not a religious individual. For me, the way I would say it is a quote from Jabotinsky, my spiritual leader, who said, "Ben Arav ben Atzeret uvni," demonstrating how all peoples should live together in the land of Israel,
which means the son of Arabs, the son of Nazareth, meaning a Christian, right?
Yeah. And me. And my son, meaning a Jew. I think for all of us, those Jews ascending to the Temple Mount and activists, we all view this place as a place of unity, as a place of peace, as a place where we never want to exclude anyone from this place, unlike our counterparts on the Muslim part, on the Muslim side. For us, it's not a compromise, it's an ideal. We want all peoples to feel free praying on the Temple Mount. And that's why I'm 100% sure that we have the moral upper hand. And that's why I'm sure that praying there is not a provocation. If we can accept Muslims praying there, there is absolutely no reason why Muslims can't accept us praying there. Yes, I do think that extremists have to be banned from the Temple Mount, those flying Hamas flags and those who call to remove all Muslims from the Temple Mount. Luckily, on our side, there are not many, because as I told you, the one thing that we can almost everyone agree on is that this place has to be a place for worship for all peoples. And I am glad to be in the camp that views it this way. And I think the people who do not view it this way, and there are obviously more of them on the other side, those are the people that are dangerous. Those are the provocators. Those are the people that needs to be removed from the Temple Mount, not those who aspire to really make this place a place for all people.
Oh, just one more question before we have to go. There's also sort of the Jewish argument that the chief rabbinate says that Jews are not allowed to pray on the Temple Mount. I know that you've said it several times, you're not religious. First of all, if I could ask you a somewhat personal question, even if you're not religious, do you keep to the rules, the Jewish law sort of rules of going to the mikveh? Do people ask you about that before you go? And second of all, how do you respond to people about that?
Okay, so two really important questions. I think the Jewish debate on this issue is very important. I will first address a personal question. I would, if that's okay, keep it between the Lord and myself.
That's fine.
But I do ask, I do get asked a lot. I think recently more women started ascending to the Temple Mount and explaining to the men ascending that this is not an appropriate question. First of all, because it's very intimate. And second of all, because it's really something that is between, you know, a woman and God. The second question about the chief rabbinate saying that Jews should not ascend to the Temple Mount, the reason they are saying it, and yes, I'm secular, but also, you know, I care about this issue, so I studied it and I tried understanding where it's coming from. It is coming from a genuine concern about the fact that Jews today are not pure enough to ascend to the Temple Mount. There are areas on the mount that those who are not pure, who came in contact with the dead, and with the lack of a red cow, you know, its ashes are supposed to purify you before ascending. It does not exist today. Those conditions do not exist. However, today with, you know, archaeological artifacts, with research, we are completely certain where are the limits that Jews are Jews are allowed or not allowed to walk at. And I mean, I don't think that's their intent, but the route that the police takes Jewish groups is does not enter those premises. So anywhere Jews walk on the Temple Mount is a later addition by King Hordas and not places that are, according to Judaism, too holy to enter while you're not pure. So I think today it's more of an argument on the ultra-Orthodox side, the rabbinical side, the rabbinate, the chief rabbinate, is more of preserving their power than really worrying about Judaism.
You think it's a political argument, you're saying?
100%. I think it's political.
It's political on your side as well, right? It's just a different 100%. Different
Right. I think if they really cared about Jews ascending properly, they would issue guidance to those who are ascending. They can't ignore the fact that people are ascending. But instead of telling them, these are the limits where you can walk or can't walk, these are the things that you need to do to ascend to the Temple Mount, they just say don't. And it's obviously politically motivated and unrealistic. People ascend. If they care about Judaism, they would guide them how to do it properly instead of just ignoring the fact that people ascend to the Temple Mount.
Our time is up, but I thank you so much for coming on the show. And this has been very interesting.
Thank you for having me.
I'm here with Joseph Gittler, the founder and chairman of Lekkit Israel, which is Israel's biggest food rescue organization. And I invited him on because I think that Lekkit is an organization that it really unites people from all different parts of Israeli society to help others. You really see the sort of spectrum of Israeli society when you visit or volunteer with Leket. And because Tisha B'Av is a time where we regret, I think, some of the great divisions between the Jewish people that have happened historically, I thought it would be nice to talk about something uniting. So, Joseph, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Tell our listeners a little bit about Leket.
So Leket is, as you mentioned, and thank you for the warm introduction, Leket is Israel's largest food rescue organization. And what that means simply is we are out there day in, day out, searching for sources of food, healthy, nutritious, readily available, that for all different types of mainly economic reasons would end up going to the trash. So that could be excess meals coming from catering halls, from hotels, from army bases, from corporate cafeterias. That's one of our main projects. And but our largest project, and in fact where our name comes from, Leket, gleaning, is the work we do with farmers who also have all types of situations where crops they've picked don't get sold, sometimes because they look funny, sometimes because market prices are so low that it doesn't make sense to pick them, although it's hard for anyone in Israel to imagine that market prices could be low these days, considering the prices of fruits and vegetables in the supermarkets. But there are all types of instances. And so what we do is we figure out who has the food. Almost all food producers we connect with are willing to give us that food. And then between our tens of thousands of volunteers a year and our own refrigerated and non-refrigerated trucks and staff, gather that food and then distribute it to a network of over 300 charities throughout Israel who feed the poor.
And can you tell me about some of the charities that you work with?
So I think that's, you know, with Tisha B'Av coming up, I think it's really nice to highlight that Leket works with any type of charity one can think of, religious, non-religious, Jewish, non-Jewish, soup kitchens, homeless shelters, battered women shelters, after school clubs for kids. We do a lot of work, which we take a lot of pride in, with the elderly throughout the country, and all these different population groups present their own issues, which I think if there's any way to, you know, beat back the horrors of Tisha B'Av, it's really that, figuring out ways to work with all sectors of society, work with them together, work with them well, and, you know, hopefully, you know, bring the kind of peace that we, you know, we dreamed about or we continue to dream about.
It's been a challenging time for, well, all over the world, but specifically for the poor of Israel and even people who normally would easily be able to buy themselves food because of COVID-19, because of people losing their jobs. How has Leket sort of met that challenge?
And I would add one other thing, which I referenced, which is we're seeing food inflation, which without wage inflation, makes it even more difficult for the poor to get by. We're also seeing the cost of housing increasing. So it's a very, very difficult time for those in Israel who are having trouble keeping up just economically. So we had major challenges during COVID. One, we reacted in two ways. So not surprisingly, much of our cooked food completely dried up. Tourism was closed. The hotel industry was closed. Most corporate employees were working from home, etc. And we were fortunate that we made a decision to actually purchase meals, which we did at a clip of over 1 million meals since the beginning of COVID. We primarily purchased those meals from businesses which generally give us food for free, which also was very nice for them to see us coming to their aid when possible. The only reason really we could do that is because our financial donors, understanding the gravity of the situation, came forward and said, here's funds, because not surprisingly, it costs us about five times as much to purchase and deliver a meal than to rescue and deliver a meal when we're rescuing, all the food comes for free.
So and it's not just that each meal costs five times as much, as that there's more demand for meals than before, right?
Oh yeah, we had tremendous demand. We really had trouble even keeping up. But thankfully, it wasn't just Leket. All the agencies we work with were able to find additional support over the past year. So there were instances where agencies we work with said to us, we're okay, see who else needs help now. And that's part of the teamwork. I think that's really actually a very key point, is it's not a zero-sum game. This is not the stock market. This is not the business world. Not that that needs to be a zero-sum game either. But our agencies understand that if they take food that they don't need, they might waste it. And if they waste that food, that's, you know, even worse. So we try to work together to understand what the needs are of everyone in one ecosystem so that everyone can get what's possible. The flip side, so the lack of cooked food was an explosion in the amounts of fruits and vegetables made available, again, because of the closure of the economy. And this happened all over the world, but I can speak to Israel. Many, many farmers were left with fruits and vegetables that they just couldn't sell. And so Leket, month in, month out, since March 2020, has broken records in the amount of fruits and vegetables that we've been able to get our hands on. And that came to a fore in the month of June, just now, 2021, where we rescued and distributed almost 3,500 tons.
Wow. You know,
which is about 7 million pounds in 1 month. Just to put that in perspective, our goal for the entire year was 50 million pounds. So to do nearly 7 million pounds in a month was overwhelming. And that's actually led us to experiment now with some new programming where sometimes we have such huge amounts of specific crops, like we had tomatoes and potatoes in massive amounts. So in order to make sure that we ourselves are able to distribute it, we've started as a pilot working with some manufacturers to turn some of those vegetables into salads and soups, prolonging their shelf life, and then adding value to what we give to our agency partners.
Can you give us a little bit of a picture of sort of poverty in Israel right now, and what are the different kinds of people who need Leket's help these days?
So I think it hasn't changed much since pre-COVID. We're seeing a lot of, I'd say the main difference is we're seeing a lot of younger people now, younger families, you know, who are just starting their careers and maybe aren't in high tech. And, you know, if they were in the tourism business, anything related to leisure, a lot of those jobs have disappeared. It may be temporary, but a year or two temporary can put someone under the poverty line very quickly. So that's one area we've seen a big change in, and we've tried to react to that. Another area, of course, is more help for the elderly, who some are just at great risk. There are people out there who can't get vaccinated and they need to stay at home. So we've continued in a small way purchasing meals that we know we have guaranteed meals of a certain condition that we can then deliver directly to the elderly, which we normally are not a Meals on Wheels program. We bring to a Meals on Wheels program who then bring it to the people. So that's where we're seeing the biggest increase in demand. Thankfully, the unemployment rate has dropped precipitously from the early days of COVID, but it's still almost double what it was in March 2020 when it was historically low. So a lot more Israelis need help. The government's done its part. Some people actually feel that the government's done too much, and that's kept people from rejoining the marketplace.
Right.
But It's a tricky situation, and Leket will just, we will do whatever we can to keep on growing and making sure that we can feed those in.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on to the Jerusalem Post podcast, and keep up the amazing work that you're doing.
Thank you for the opportunity. Everyone stay safe and have a wonderful summer.
And now we have something special, something a little different for you. This week, the United Arab Emirates opened their first embassy to Israel in the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange building. I was there together with Jerusalem Post intern Ben Baruch, who did some reporting live at the event.
2 weeks after an Israeli delegation traveled to Abu Dhabi to inaugurate the Israeli embassy there, the UAE returned the favor on Wednesday, sending their ambassador to Israel for the grand opening of the Emirati Embassy in the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange. The Emirati flag now flies proudly in front of the Stock Exchange, something Israeli President Isaac Herzog was proud of, considering how far the two countries have come.
Well, seeing the Emirati flag flying proudly in Tel Aviv might have seemed like a far-fetched dream just about a year ago. In many ways, nothing could be more natural and normal. So many Israelis and Emiratis have discovered our countries and people share a great deal. It's especially befitting that we're doing this in the Israeli and Tel Aviv Stock Exchange, a central pillar of Israeli economy.
As the two nations continue to achieve historic milestones since the Abraham Accords in August 2020, it's becoming clearer what peace between Israel and a Gulf state looks like. This isn't the peace of conferences and meetings, but a peace defined by trust in its citizens to collaborate and create a strong, vibrant Middle East. That's also why the location in the heart of Tel Aviv's business district is so significant.
Peace is not born in big conferences. Peace is born in the hearts and minds of human beings. And the peace between our nations would benefit both our peoples and in various fields.
UAE's ambassador to Israel, Mohammed Al-Hajja, said the embassy is an important step in the peace process between the two countries. He said it will be a base, not just for diplomats, but for the two countries to build on the Abraham Accords. Al-Hajja also spoke about the significance of the location as it represents the two countries' partnership in technology, health, and business.
Since the normalization of ties between Israel and the UAE, we have seen for the first time discussions on trade and investment opportunities. Collaboration between hospitals, universities, and research centers. Cultural and people-to-people exchanges. Cooperation in combating COVID-19. Countering cyber threats and protecting our environment.
Itai Ben-Zeev, CEO of the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange, agreed and added that the embassy's location proves that the Emiratis are serious about making peace and becoming long-term partners.
Well, the way I see it, this is a signature of the embassy saying, you know, we want to do business with the Israeli community. We believe in a lot of the businesses, the startups, the high-tech and other sectors that we have in Israel, and I think that it demonstrates the importance that they see in executing the Abraham Accords in the near future.
He added that this will help collaboration, not just between Israel and the UAE, but between diplomats and business executives. He hopes the embassy will help businesses in both countries flourish. Although Ben-Zeev said there's no more office space available for another embassy in the stock exchange, he appreciates having another country's embassy there. He said he would be open to adding more should the office space theoretically become available.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll be back next week.